3. To die in the now. Push it on to the next moment. Don't think now. Save it for later, when thinking will show its useless face, when it's too late and worry is wasted in the rush for cover. Push it past into that pocket so that it relents its gnawing presence, and nothing is worth doing in pointless grace when all the valid suppositions smother your cries. Push it over into the deep hole you don't want to know in case it breaks and makes you feel cruel reminders when all you could have done is now past. No, don't bother. Push it well into the corner, it's no use, so spare me the grief. You didn't like the cost, so bright, so high, the bloodiest cut, when all you sought was sweet pleasure to the end of your days. Push it on until it pushes back, shout your shock, shout it. You never imagined, you never knew what turning away would do. Now wail out your dread in waves of disbelief. It's done, it's dead. Push your way to the front, clawing the eyes of screaming kin. No legacy awaits your shining children. It's killed, killed. Gone the future, all to feed some holy glory. The world is over. Over. Siban's Dying Confession. Siban of Aaron. Chapter 13. We watched him approach from a league away, staggering beneath the weight of all he held in his arms. We thought he wore a crown, but when he came near, the circlet was revealed as the skin of a serpent biting its tail. We laughed and shared the carafe when he fell, cheering as he climbed back upright in pleasing charm. We slowed into silence when he arrived and saw for ourselves the burden he carried, kept from harm. We held stern in the face of his relieved smile, and he said this fresh young world he had found was now ours. We looked on as if we were grand gods, contemplating a host of undeserved gifts, drawing knives. Bold with pride, we cut free blooded slices, shared out this bright dripping bounty, and ate our fill. We saw him weep then when nothing was left, backing away with eyes of pain and dismay, arms falling. But wolves will make of any world a carcass. We simply replied with our natures revealed in all innocence. We proclaimed with zeal our humble purity, though now he turned away and did not hear as the taste soured. And the betrayal of poison crept into our limbs. We watched him walk away, now a league, maybe more. His lonely march, his morning departure from our kindness, his happy annihilation of our mindless selves, snake-bit unto death. The Last Days of Our Inheritance, Fisher Keltath. The vast springs of the carriage slammed down to absorb the thundering impact. Then, as the enormous conveyance surged back up, Gruntle caught a momentary glimpse of one of the Bowl brothers, his grip torn loose, wheeling through the grainy air, arms scything, legs kicking, face wide with bemused surprise. His tether snapped taut, and Gruntle saw that the idiot had tied it to one of his ankles. The man plunged down and out of sight. The horses were screaming, manes whipping in their frantic heaves forward across stony, broken ground. Shadowy figures voiced muted cries as the beasts trampled them under hoof, and the carriage rocked sickeningly over bodies. Someone was shrieking in his ear, and Gruntle twisted round on his perch on the carriage roof to see the other Bowl brother, Jeweler, tugging on the tether. A foot appeared, moccasin gone, long knobby toes splayed wide as if seeking a branch, and then the shin and lumpy knee. A moment later, Amby reached up, found a handhold, and pulled himself back onto the roof, wearing the strangest grin Gruntle had ever seen. In the half-light, the Tregal carriage raced onward, plunging through seething masses of people. Even as they carved through like a ship cutting crazed seas, ragged, rotting arms reached up to the sides. Some caught hold only to have their arms torn from their sockets. Others were pulled off their feet, and these ones started climbing, seeking better purchase. Upon which the primary function of the shareholders was made apparent. Sweetest Sufferance, the short, plump woman with the bright smile, was now snarling, wailing with a hatchet into an outreaching arm. Bones snapped like sticks, and she shouted as she kicked into a leering, desiccated face, hard enough to punch the head from the shoulders. Damned corpses! They were riding through a sea of animated corpses, and it seemed that virtually every one of them wanted to book passage. A large, brutish shape reared up beside Gruntle. Bargast, hairy as an ape, filed blackened teeth revealed in a delighted grin. Releasing one hand from the brass rung, Gruntle tugged loose one of his cutlasses, slashed the heavy blade into the corpse's face. It reeled away, the bottom half of the grin suddenly gone. Twisting further round, Gruntle kicked the Bargast in the chest. The apparition fell back. A moment later, someone else appeared, narrow-shouldered, the top of its head an elongated pate with a nest of mousy hair perched on the crown, a wizened face beneath it. Gruntle kicked again. The carriage pitched wildly as the huge wheels rolled over something big. Gruntle felt himself swinging out over the roof edge, and he shouted in pain as his hand was wrenched where it gripped a rung. Clawed fingers scrabbled against his thighs, and he kicked in growing panic. His heel struck something that didn't yield, and he used that purchase to launch himself back onto the roof. On the opposite side, three dead men were now mauling Sweetest Sufferance, each one seemingly intent on some kind of rape. She twisted and writhed beneath them, chopping with her hatchets, biting at their withered hands and head-butting the ones that tried for a kiss. Recanto Ilk then joined the fray, using a strange saw-toothed knife as he attacked various joints, shoulders, knees, elbows, and tossing the severed limbs over the side as he went. Gruntle lifted himself onto his knees and glared out across the landscape. The masses of dead, he realized, were all moving in one direction, whilst the carriage cut obliquely into their path, and as the resistance before them built, figures converging like blood to a wound, forward momentum began inexorably to slow, the horses stamping high as they clambered over ever more undead. Someone was shouting near the rear of the carriage, and Gruntle turned to see the woman named Faint leaning down over the side, yelling through the shuttered window. Another heavy blow buffeted the carriage, and something demonic roared. Claws tore free a chunk of wood. "Get us out of here!" Gruntle could not agree more, as the demon suddenly loomed into view, reptilian arms reaching for him. Snarling, he leapt to his feet, both weapons now in hand. An elongated, fanged face lunged at him, hissing. Gruntle roared back, a deafening sound, cutlasses lashing out. Edges slammed into thick hide, sliced deep into lifeless flesh, down to the bones of the demon's long neck. He saw something like surprise flicker in the creature's pitted eyes, and then the head and half of the neck fell away. Two more savage chops sent its forearms spinning. The body plunged back, and even as it did so, smaller corpses were scrambling onto it as if climbing a ladder. He now heard a strange sound ahead, rhythmic, like the clashing of weapons against shield rims. But the sound was too loud for that, too overwhelming, unless Gruntle straightened and faced forward. An army indeed. Dead soldiers, moving in ranks, in squares and wedges, marching along with all the rest, and in numbers unimaginable. He stared, struggling to comprehend the vastness of the force. As far as he could see before them, gods below, all of the dead on the march. But where? To what war? The scene suddenly blurred, dispersed in fragments. The carriage seemed to slump under him. Darkness swept in, a smell of the sea, the thrash of waves, sand sliding beneath the wheels. The carriage side nearest him lurched into the bole of a palm tree, sending down a rain of cusser-sized nuts that pounded along the roof before bounding away. The horses stumbled, slowing their wild plunge, and a moment later everything came to a sinking halt. Looking up, Gruntle saw stars in a gentle night sky. Beneath him, the carriage door creaked open, and someone clambered out to vomit onto the sands, coughing and spitting and cursing. Master Quell. Gruntle climbed down, using the spokes of the nearest wheel, and, his legs feeling shaky under him, made his way to the sorcerer. The man was still on his hands and knees, hacking out the last dregs of whatever had been in his stomach.
"Oh," he gasped, "my aching head."
Faint came up alongside Gruntle. She'd been wearing an iron skullcap, but she'd lost it, and now her hair hung in matted strands, framing her round face.
"I thought a damned tiger had landed on us," she said. "But it was you, putting the terror into a demon. So it's true, those tattoos aren't tattoos at all."
Glano Tarp had dropped down, dodging to avoid the snapping teeth of the nearest horses.
"Did you see Ambi Bol go flying? Gods, that was stupacular!"
Gruntle frowned.
"Stew what?"
"Stupidly spectacular," explained Faint. "Or spectacularly stupid. Are you soul taken?"
He glanced at her, then set off to explore. A task quickly accomplished. They were on an island, a very small island, less than 50 paces across. The sand was crushed coral, gleaming silver in the starlight. 2 palm trees rose from the centre. In the surrounding shallows, 1,000 paces out, ribbons of reef ran entirely round the atoll, breaking the surface like the spine of a sea serpent. More islands were visible, few bigger than the one they were on, stretching out like the beads of a broken necklace, the nearest one perhaps 3,000 paces distant. As he returned, he saw a corpse plummeting down from the carriage roof to thump in the sand. After a moment, it sat up.
"Oh,"
it said. The trell emerged from the carriage, followed by the swamp witch, Precious Thimble, who looked ghostly pale as she stumbled a few steps, then promptly sat down on the sand. Seeing Gruntle, Mappo walked over.
"I gather," he said, "we encountered something unexpected in Hood's realm."
"I wouldn't know," Gruntle replied. "It was my first visit."
"Unexpected?" Faint snorted. "That was insane. All the dead in existence on the march."
"Where to?" Gruntle asked.
"Maybe not to, maybe from."
From? In retreat? Now that was an alarming notion.
"If the dead are on the run..."
"Used to be," Faint mused. "The realm of the dead was an easy ride, peaceful. But in the last few years, something's going on."
She walked over to Master Quell.
"So, if that's not going to work, Quell, what now?"
The man, still on his hands and knees, looked up.
"You just don't get it, do you?"
"What?"
"We didn't even reach the damned gate."
"But then what?"
"There wasn't any gate,"
the mage shrieked. A long silence followed. Nearby, the undead man was collecting seashells. Jula Bowles' watery eyes fixed on Precious Thimble, dreamy with adoration. Seeing this, Ambi did the same, trying to make his expression even more desirous, so that when she finally looked over, she would see that he was the right one for her, the only one for her. As the moment stretched, the competition grew fierce. His left leg still ached, from the hip right down to his toes, and he had only 1 moccasin, but at least the sand was warm, so that wasn't too bad. Precious Thimble was in a meeting with Master Quell and that scary barbed man and the hairy giant ogre named Mappo. These were the important people, he decided, and accepting Precious Thimble, he wanted nothing to do with them. Standing too close to those folk was never healthy. Heads explode, hearts burst. He'd seen it with his own eyes, back when he was a runt, but not nearly as much of a runt as Jula, and the family had decided at last to fight the Malazans who were showing up in their swamp like poison mushrooms. Buna Bol had been running things back then, before he got eaten by a toad, but it was a fact that Buna's next to closest brothers, the ones who wanted to get closer, all went and got themselves killed, exploding heads, bursting hearts, boiling livers. It was the law of dodging, of course. Marshals and their sub-marshals were smart, and smart meant fast. So when the arrows and quarrels and waves of magic flew, why, they dodged out of the way. Anybody round them, trying to be as smart but not smart at all, and so just that much slower, well, they didn't dodge quick enough. Jula finally sighed, announcing his defeat, and looked over at Ambi.
"I can't believe I saved you." "I can't neither. I wouldn't have. That's why I can't believe that's what I did. But then she's seen how brave I am, how generous and selfless. She's seen I'm better because she knows you wouldn't have done it." "Maybe I would have, and maybe she knows that, Jula. Besides, one of them six smelly ones was trying to open the doors, and if it wasn't for me, he'd have got in. And that's what she really saw." "You didn't scrape that one off on purpose." "How do you know?" "Because you butted him with your face, Ambi."
Ambi tested his nose again and winced, and then he sneered.
"She saw what she saw, and what she saw wasn't you. She saw my hands reaching down to drag you back up. She saw that." "She didn't. I made sure by covering them with my shirt." "You lie. You lie. No, you. You. You can say what you like, Ambi, whatever you like. It was me saving you. Pulling off my moccasin, you mean? That was an accident." "Yeah, then where is it?" "Fell off the side." "No, it didn't. I checked your bag, Jula. You wasn't trying to save me at all. You were stealing my moccasin because it's your favourite moccasin. I want it back." "It's against the law to look in someone else's bag. Swamp law. Does this look like a swamp?" "That doesn't matter. You broke the law. Anyway, what you found was my spare moccasin." "Your one spare moccasin?" "That's right. Then why was it full of my love notes?" "What love notes?" "The ones me and her been writing back and forth. The ones I hid in my moccasin. Those ones, Jula." "What's obvious now is just how many times you've been breaking the law. Because you've been hiding your love notes, which you write to yourself and nobody else, you've been hiding them in my spare moccasin. Not that you'd ever look. But I might, if I knew about it." "You didn't, though, did you? Besides, you don't have a spare moccasin, because I stole it. And that's why I stole it back. You can't steal back what you didn't know was stolen in the first place. That's just stealing, and stealing's against the law. Swamp law. Your bag is a swamp. Ha 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 ha."
And Ambi grinned at his own joke, and then he too laughed. Faint tugged the stopper free and took a swig, then handed the skin to Sweetest Sufferance.
"Listen to those idiots," she said.
"I don't want to,"
Sweetest Sufferance replied, and then she shivered.
"That was the first time, you know, them trying to get in my trousers like that."
"Cursed with rigor mortis, maybe,"
she snorted.
"You kidding me? Whatever they had down there wasn't even real, like maybe sticks tied on or something."
She drank down some wine, then sighed and looked round.
"Pretty. Our tiny piece of paradise. We can watch the sun come up, at least. That will be nice."
She was quiet for a moment before resuming.
"When Recanto showed up, I thought he was helping, but now I think he was just using the situation to get a few handfuls of his own."
"Are you surprised, sweetie? He's a man with bad eyes. Bad eyes and bad hands. I might have to murder him." "Hold on," said Faint, taking the skin back. "He did save you, cutting off arms and hands.
Eliminating the competition.
Defending your honour, sweetie.
If you say so."
Faint replaced the stopper.
"Gods below, sweetie. What do you think we ran into back there?"
Sweetest Sufferance pursed her plump lips, long-lashed lids settling down over her eyes.
"Back in One Eye Cat, when I was a child, I was taken to a dawn of flies. You know, those ceremonies from the Temple of Hood, when all the priests paint themselves in honey."
"In some places," cut in Faint, "they use blood."
"So I've heard. In One Eye Cat, it was honey, so that the flies stuck. Flies and wasps, actually. Anyway, I was with my grandfather, who'd been a soldier in the Revenants. Gods, it's been a long time since I last heard them mentioned.
Faint stared across at Sweetest Sufferance.
Is this true? Your grandfather was with the Revenants?
So he always told it. When I was very young, I believed every word he said. When I was older, I didn't believe any of it. And now I'm still older, I've gone back to believing him. Things in his house, the carved flagstones, the broken masks he had on the wall. Yes, Faint, I believe he was at that.
Commanded by Segula.
An outlawed Segula, yes. Anyway, it was my grandfather who took me to watch his old company's patron temple and all the priests and priestesses doing their flies thing.
Wait, the Revenants were supposed to have all disappeared, taken by Hood himself to serve him in the realm of the dead. So what was your grandfather doing living in One Eye Cat?
He lost his sword arm in a battle. He'd been left for dead, and by the time anyone found him, it was too late for any serious healing. So they seared the stump and retired him out. Now, you going to let me tell my tale or not?
Yes, fine. Sorry.
He said the priests were getting it all wrong with that honey. The flies and wasps weren't the important thing in the ceremony. It was the blood. Honey, but that symbolized blood. The Revenants, who were as good as Hood's own warrior priests, in the mortal world anyway, well, they were flagellants. Blood on the skin, life bled out to die on the skin. That was the important detail. It's why Hood cherishes dead soldiers more than any other of the countless dead that stumble through the gate. The merchants of blood, the army that will fight on the hidden plain called Defiance last.
She paused, then licked her lips.
That's what the Dawn of Flies is about. A final battle. The dead gathered on a hidden plain called Defiance Last.
So,
said Faint, feeling chilled by Sweetest Sufferance's story.
Maybe that's why Hood took the Revenants, because that battle is coming.
Give me some more of that,
Sweetest Sufferance said, reaching for the wineskin. Glano Tarp nudged Recanto Ilk.
See 'em? They're talking about us. Well, me, mostly. It's going to happen, Ilk. Sooner or later, it's going to happen.
Recanto Ilk squinted across at the man.
What? They're going to kill you in your sleep?
Don't be an idiot. One of them's going to ask me to forever marry her.
And then she'll kill you in your sleep. And then we can all slice up your share.
You think I didn't see how you groped, sweetie?
How could you? You was driving.
There ain't nothing that I don't see, Ilk. That's what makes me such a gudiferous driver.
She's got the nicest handholds.
Watch what you're doing with my future forever wife.
Could be Faint you end up with, which means I can do what I like with sweetie.
Glano Tarp loosed a loud belch.
We should make up something to eat. Breakfast, so when they're finished jawbering over there, we can up and get on our way.
Wherever that is.
Wherever don't matter. Never has and never will.
Recanto Ilk grinned.
Right. It ain't the destination that counts.
And together they added, it's the journey. Faint and Sweetest Sufferance looked over, both scowling.
Not that again,
Faint called.
Just stop it, you two! Stop it, or we'll kill you in your sleep!
Recanto Ilk nudged Glano Tarp. Mappo crouched, rocking on the balls of his broad feet, waiting for Master Quell to finish his muttered incantation against pain. He sympathized, since it was clear that the mage was suffering, his face pale and drawn, forehead slick with sweat, his hands trembling. That anyone would choose such a profession, given the terrible cost, was a difficult notion to accept. Was coin worth this? He could not understand that sort of thinking. What held real value in this world, in any world? Friendship, the gifts of love and compassion. The honor one accorded the life of another person. None of this could be bought with wealth. It seemed to him such a simple truth. Yet he knew that its very banality was fuel for sneering cynicism and mockery. until such things were taken away, until the price of their loss came to be personal in some terrible, devastating arrival into one's life. Only at that moment of profound extremity did the contempt wash down from that truth, revealing it bare, undeniable. All the truths that mattered were banal. Yet here was another truth. He had paid for this journey. His coin bought this man's pain. The exchange was imbalanced, and so Mappo grieved for Master Quill, and would not shy away from his own guilt. Honour meant, after all, a preparedness, a willingness to weigh and measure, to judge rightful balance with no hand tilting the scales. And so, they all here were paying to serve Mappo's need, this journey through Warrens, another burden he must accept, if he could. The formidable warrior sitting beside him stirred then and said,
"I think I see now why the Trigal loses so many shareholders, Master Quill. By the abyss, there must be warrens where one can journey through in peace."
Master Quill rubbed at his face.
"Realms resist, Gruntle. We are like a splash of water in hot oil. It's all I can do to not bounce us off. Mages can push themselves into their chosen warrens. It's not easy. It's a game of subtle persuasion most of the time, or a modest assertion of will. You don't want to blast a hole from one realm to the next, because that's likely to go out of control. It can devour a mage in an instant." He looked up at them with bloodshot eyes. "We can't do it that way." He waved a weak hand at the carriage behind him. "We arrive like an insult. We are an insult. Like a white-hot spear point, we punch through, race along our wild path, and all that we leave in our wake, I need to make sure, is cauterized, seared shut. Failing that, a rush of power explodes behind us, and that's a wave no mortal can ride for long."
Precious Thimble spoke from behind Mappo.
"You must be high mages, then, one and all."
To her observation, Master Quell nodded.
"I admit it's starting to trouble me, this way of travel. I think we're scarring the whole damned universe. We're making existence bleed. Oh, just a seep here and there, amidst whatever throbs of pain reality might possess. In any case, that's why there's no peaceful path, Gruntle. Denizens in every realm are driven to annihilate us."
"You said we did not even reach Hood's Gate," the barbed man said after a moment. "And yet—"
"Aye," he spat onto the sand, "the dead sleep no more. What a damned mess."
"Find us the nearest land in our own world," said Mappo. "I will walk from there, make my own way."
"We stay true to the contract, Trell. We'll deliver you where you want to go."
"Not at the price of you and your companions possibly dying. I cannot accept that, Master Quill."
"We don't do refunds."
"I do not ask for one."
Master Quill rose shakily.
"We'll see after our next leg. For now, it's time for breakfast. There's nothing worse than heaving when there's nothing in the gut to heave."
Gruntle also straightened.
"You have decided on a new path?"
Quell grimaced.
"Look around, Gruntle. It's been decided for us."
Mappo rose and remained at Gruntle's side as Quell staggered to his crew, who were gathered round a brazier they had dragged out from the belly of the carriage. The Trell squinted at the modest plot of land.
"What did he mean?"
he asked. Gruntle shrugged. When he smiled at Mappo, his fangs gleamed.
"Since I have to guess, Trell, I'd say we're going for a swim."
And Precious Thimble snorted.
"Male's realm. And you two thought Hood was bad."
When she was 4 years old, Precious Thimble was given a breathing tube and buried in peat, where she remained for 2 days and one night. She probably died. Most of them did, but the soul remained in the dead body, trapped by the peat and its dark, sorcerous qualities. This was how the old witches explained things. A child must be given into the peat, into that unholy union of earth and water. and the soul must be broken free of the flesh it dwelt within, for only then could that soul travel, only then could that soul wander free in the realm of dreams. She had few memories of that time in the peat. Perhaps she screamed, sought to thrash in panic. The ropes that bound her, that would be used to pull her free at dusk of the second day, had left deep burns on her wrists and her neck, and these burns had not come from the gentle, measured pressure when the witches had drawn her back into the world. It was also whispered that sometimes the spirits that lurked in the peat sought to steal the child's body, to make it a place of their own. And the witches who sat guarding the temporary grave told of times when the rope, its ends wrapped about their wrists, suddenly grew taut, and a battle would then begin between the witches of the surface and the spirits of the deep. Sometimes, it was admitted, the witches lost, the ropes were gnawed unto breaking, and the child was pulled into the foul deep, emerging only once every year on the night of the awakened. Children with blue-brown skin and hollowed-out eye sockets, with hair the colour of rust or blood, with long-polished nails, walking the swamp and singing songs of the earth that could drive a mortal mad. Had spirits come for her? The witches would not say. Were the burns on her skin the result of panic or something else? She did not know. Her memories of that time were few and visceral. The weight on her chest, the seeping cold, the taste of fetid water in her mouth, the stinging in her squeezed shut eyes, and the sounds she could hear, terrible trickling sounds, like the rush of fluids in the veins of the earth, the thumps and crunches, the crackling approach of things. It was said there was no air in the peat, that not even her skin could breathe, and such breathing was necessary to all life. And so she must have died, in truth. Since then, at night, when she slept, she could rise from her flesh, could hover invisible above her motionless body, and look down in admiration. She was beautiful indeed, as if something of the child she had been never aged, was immune to growing old, a quality that made men desperate to claim her, not as an equal, alas, but as a possession. And the older the man, the greater the need. When she had made this discovery about herself and about the men who most desired her, she was disgusted. Why give this gorgeous body to such wrinkled, pathetic creatures? She would not, ever. Yet she found it difficult to defend herself against such needy hunters of youth. Oh, she could curse them into misery, she could poison them and see them die in great pain, but such things only led her to pity. The soft kind, not the nasty kind, which made being cruel just that much harder. She had found her solution in the two young Bowl brothers, barely out of their teens, neither one well suited to staying in the Mott Irregulars, for certain reasons over which she need not concern herself, and both of them gloriously in love with her. It did not matter that they barely had a single brain between them. They were bowls, ferocious against mages and magic of any kind, and born with the salamander god's gift of survival. They protected her in all the battles one could imagine, from out-and-out fighting to the devious predations of old men. When she was done admiring her own body, she would float over to where they slept and look down upon their slack faces, on the gaping mouths from which snores groaned out in wheezing cadence, the threads of drool and the twitching eyelids, her pups, her guard dogs, her deadly hounds. Yet now, on this night with the tropical stars peering down, Precious Thimble felt a growing unease. This Trigal venture she decided on, this whim, was proving far deadlier than she had expected. In fact, she'd almost lost one of them in Hood's realm, and losing one of them would be bad. It would free the other one to close in, and that she didn't want, not at all. And one guard dog wasn't nearly as effective as two. Maybe, just maybe, she'd gone too far this time. Gruntle opened his eyes and watched as the faintly glowing emanation floated over to hover above the sleeping forms of the Bowl brothers, where it lingered for a time before returning to sink back down into the form of Precious Thimble.
From nearby, he heard the Trell's soft grunt, and then,
"What game does she play at, I wonder?"
Gruntle thought to reply. Instead, sleep took him suddenly, pouncing, tumbling his mind away and down, spitting him out like a mangled rat into a damp glade of high grass. The sun blazed down like a god's enraged eye. Feeling battered, misused, he rose onto all fours, a position that did not feel at all awkward or strike him as unusual. Solid jungle surrounded the clearing, from which came the sounds of countless birds, monkeys, and insects, a cacophony so loud and insistent that a growl of irritation rose from deep in his throat. All at once the nearest sounds ceased, a cocoon of silence broken only by the hum of bees and a pair of long-tailed hummingbirds dancing in front of an orchid, sprites that then raced off in a beating whir of wings. Gruntle felt his hackles rise, stiff and prickling on the back of his neck, too fierce for a human. And looking down, he saw the sleek, banded forelimbs of a tiger where his arms and hands should have been.
"Another one of these damned dreams. Listen, Drake, if you want me to be just like you, stop playing these scenes for me. I'll be a tiger if that's what you want. Just don't confine it to my dreams. I wake up feeling clumsy and slow, and I don't like it. I wake up remembering nothing but freedom."
Something was approaching.
Things. 3, no, 5. Not big, not dangerous.
He slowly swung his head round, narrowing his gaze. The creatures that came to the edge of the clearing were somewhere between apes and humans. Small as adolescents, lithe and sleek, with fine fur thickening at the armpits and crotch. The two males carried short curved batons of some sort, fire-hardened with inset fangs from some large carnivore. The females wielded spears, one of them holding her spear in one hand and a broad flint axe head in the other, which she tossed into the clearing. The object landed with a thump, flattening the grasses, halfway between Gruntle and the band. Gruntle realized with a faint shock that he knew the taste of these creatures, their hot flesh, their blood, the saltiness of their sweat. In this form, in this place, and in this time, he had hunted them, had pulled them down, hearing their piteous cries as his jaws closed fatally round their necks. This time, however, he was not hungry, and it seemed they knew it. Awe flickered in their eyes, their mouths twisting into strange expressions. And all at once one of the women was speaking. The language trilled, punctuated by clicks and glottal stops. And Gruntle understood her.
"Beast of darkness and fire, hunter in dark and light, fur of night and motion in grasses, god who takes, see this our gift, and spare us, for we are weak and few, and this land is not ours. This land is the journey, for we dream of the shore, where food is plenty, and the birds cry in the heat of the sun."
Gruntle found himself sliding forward, silent as a thought, and he was life and power bound in a single breath, forward until the axe blade was at his taloned paws. Head lowering, nostrils flaring as he inhaled the scent of stone and sweat, the edges where old blood remained, where grasses had polished the flint, the urine that had been splashed upon it. These creatures wanted to claim this glade for their own. They were begging permission, and maybe something more, something like protection.
"The leopard tracks us and challenges you," the woman sang. "But she will not cross your path. She will flee your scent, for you are the master here, the god. The unchallenged hunter of the forest. Last night, she took my child. We have lost all our children. Perhaps we will be the last. Perhaps we will never find the shore again. But if our flesh must feed the hungry, then let it be you who grow strong with our blood. Tonight, if you come to take one of us, take me. I am the eldest. I bear no more children. I am useless."
She hunched down then, discarding her spear, and sank into the grasses, where she rolled onto her back, exposing her throat. They were mad, Gruntel decided, driven insane by the terrors of the jungle, where they were strangers, lost, seeking some distant coastline. And as they journeyed, every night delivered horror. But this was a dream from some ancient time, and even if he sought to guide them to the shore, he would awaken long before that journey was completed, awaken and so abandon them to their fates. And what if he grew hungry in this next moment? What if his instinct exploded within him, launching him at this hapless female, closing his jaws on her throat? Was this where the notion of human sacrifice came from? When nature eyed them, avid with hunger? When they had naught but sharpened sticks and a smouldering fire to protect them? He would not kill them this night. He would find something else to kill. Gruntel set off into the jungle. 1,000 scents filled him. 1,000 muted noises whispered in the deep shadows. He carried his massive weight effortlessly, silent as he padded forward. Beneath the canopy the world was dusk, and so it would ever remain. Yet he saw everything, the flit of a green-winged mantis, the scuttle of woodlice in the humus, the gliding escape of a millipede. He slipped across the path of deer, saw where they had fed on dark-leaved shoots. He passed a rotted log that had been torn apart and pushed aside, the ground beneath ravaged by the questing snouts of boar. Sometime later, with night descending, he found the spoor he had been seeking. Acrid, pungent, both familiar and strange. It was sporadic, proof that the creature that left it was cautious, taking to the trees in its moments of rest. A female. He slowed his pace as he tracked the beast. All light was gone now, every color shifted into hues of grey. If she discovered him, she would flee. But then, the only beast that wouldn't was the elephant, and he had no interest in hunting that wise leviathan with its foul sense of humour. Edging forward, one soft step at a time, he came upon the place where she had made a kill. A wapiti, its panic a bitter breath in the air, the humour scuffed by its tiny hoofs, a smear of blood on curled black leaves. Halting, settling down, Gruntel lifted his gaze. And found her. She had drawn her prey up onto a thick branch from which lianas depended in a cascade of night blossoms. The wapiti, or what remained of it, was draped across the bowl, and she was lying along the branch's length, lambent eyes fixed upon Gruntel. This leopard was well suited to hunting at night. Her coat was black on black, the spots barely discernible. She regarded him without fear, and this gave Gruntel pause. A voice then murmured in his skull, sweet and dark.
Go on your way, Lord. There is not enough to share. Even if I so desired, which of course I do not.
I have come for you, Gruntel replied.
Her eyes widened, and he saw muscles coiling along her shoulders.
Do all beasts know riders, then?
For a moment, Gruntel did not comprehend her question, and then understanding arrived with sudden heat, sudden interest.
Has your soul travelled far, my lady?
Through time, through unknown distances. This is where my dreams take me every night. Ever hunting, ever tasting blood, ever shying from the path of the likes of you, Lord.
I am summoned by prayer,
Gruntel said, knowing even as he said it that it was the truth, that the half-human creatures he had left behind did indeed call upon him, as if to invite the killer answered some innate refusal of random chance. He was summoned to kill, he realized, to give proof to the notion of fate.
Curious idea, Lord.
Spare them, lady.
Oh.
You know of whom I speak. In this time, there is but one creature that can voice prayers.
He sensed wry amusement.
You are wrong in that. Although the others have no interest in imagining beasts as gods and goddesses.
Others?
Many nights away from this place, there are mountains, and in them can be found fastnesses where dwell the Kachin Chimal. There is a vast river that runs to a warm ocean, and on its banks can be found the pit cities of the Fokrul Asael. There are solitary towers where lone Jagut live, waiting to die. There are the villages of the Tarthanotoblakai, and their tundra-dwelling cousins, the Nef Trell.
You know this world far better than I do, lady.
Do you still intend to kill me?
Will you cease hunting the half-humans?
As you like, but you must know there are times when this beast has no rider. There are times, too, I suspect, when the beast you now ride also hunts alone.
I understand.
She rose from her languid perch and made her way down the trunk of the tree head first, landing lightly on the soft forest floor.
Why are they so important to you?
I do not know. Perhaps I pity them.
For our kind, Lord, there is no room for pity.
I disagree. It is what we can give when we ride the souls of these beasts. Hood knows it's all we can give.
Hood?
The god of death.
You come from a strange world, I think.
Now this was startling. Gruntle was silent for a long moment, and then he asked,
Where are you from, lady?
A city called New Morn.
I know of a ruin named Morn.
My city is no ruin.
Perhaps you exist in a time before the coming of Hood.
Perhaps.
She stretched, the glow of her eyes thinning to slits.
I am leaving soon, Lord. If you are here when I do, the beast that remains will not take kindly to your presence.
Oh, and would she be so foolish as to attack me?
And die? No. But I would not curse her with terror.
Ah, is that pity, then?
No, it is love.
Yes, he could see how one could come to love such magnificent animals and find the riding of their souls a most precious gift.
I will go now, lady. Do you think we will meet again?
It does seem we share the night, Lord.
She slipped away, and even Gruntle's extraordinary vision failed him from tracking her beyond a few strides. He swung about and padded off in the opposite direction. Yes, he could feel his own grip here weakening, and soon he would return to his own world, that pallid, stale existence where he lived as if half blind, half deaf, deadened and clumsy. He allowed himself a deep cough of anger, silencing the unseen denizens on all sides. Until some brave monkey high overhead flung a stick at him. The thump, as it struck the ground near his left hind leg, made him start and shy away. From the darkness overhead, he heard chittering laughter. The storm of chaos cavorted into his vision, consuming half the sky with a swirling madness of lead, grainy black, and blazing tendrils of argent. He could see the gust front tearing the ground up in a frenzied wall of dust, rocks, and dirt, growing ever closer. Imminent oblivion did not seem so bad as far as Ditch was concerned. He was being dragged by the chain shackled to his right ankle. Most of his skin had been scraped away. The white bone and cartilage of his remaining elbow, studded with grit, was visible within halos of red. His knees were larger versions, and the shackle was slowly carving through his ankle and foot bones. He wondered what would happen when that foot was finally torn off, how it would feel. He lay there, motionless at last, perhaps watching that shackle tumble and twist and stutter away. He'd be free. The torment of this existence should not include pain. That was unfair. Of course, most of that pain was fading now. He was too far gone to curl and flinch, to gasp and sob, but the memories remained like fire in his skull. Pulled onward over loose stones, their sharp edges rolling up his back, gouging new furrows through the pulped meat, knuckling against the base of his skull to tear away the last few snarls of hair and scalp. And as the chain snagged, only to give and twist him round, he stared again and again upon that storm in their wake. Songs of suffering from the groaning wagon somewhere ahead, an unending chorus of misery ever drifting back. Too bad, he reflected, that the huge demon had not found him in the moments following his collapse, had not lifted him to its shoulder, not that it could carry any more than it already had been carrying. But even if it had done little more than drag him to one side, then the edge of the wagon's massive wheel would not have crushed his right arm and shoulder, grinding both into pulp until threads of gristle were all that held it to his body. After that, all hopes, faint as they had been, of rising again to add his strength to the procession had vanished. He had become yet one more dead weight, dragged in the wake, adding to the suffering of those who trudged on. Nearby, almost parallel to him, a huge chain sheathed in moss ended in the remnants of a dragon. Wings like tattered sails, spars snapped and dangling, the mostly skinless head dragged behind a shredded neck. When he had first seen it, he had been shocked, horrified. Now, each time it came into view, he felt a wave of dread. That such a creature should have failed was proof of the desperate extremity now plaguing them. Anamanda Rake had stopped killing. The Legion was failing. Annihilation edged ever closer.
Life fears chaos. It was ever thus. We fear it more than anything else, because it is anathema. Order battles against dissolution. Order negotiates cooperation as a mechanism of survival, on every scale, from a patch of skin to an entire menagerie of interdependent creatures. That cooperation, of course, may not of essence be necessarily peaceful. A minute exchange of failures to ensure greater successes. Yes, as I am dragged along here, at the very end of my existence, I begin to understand. See me, see this gift of contemplation. Rake, what have you done?
A calloused hand closed about his remaining arm, lifted him clear of the ground, and he was being carried forward, closer to that crawling wagon.
There is no point.
That, replied a deep, measured voice, is without relevance.
I am not worth...
Probably not, but I intend to find you room on that wagon.
Ditch hacked a ragged laugh.
Just tear my foot off, good sir, and leave me.
No, there may be need for you, mage.
Need? Now that was an absurd thing to say.
Who are you?
Draconis.
Ditch laughed a second time.
I looked for you. Seems centuries ago now.
Now you have found me.
I thought you might know a way of escaping. Now isn't that funny? After all, if you had, you would not still be here, would you?
That seems logical.
An odd reply.
Draconis.
What?
Are you a logical man?
Not in the least. Now, here we are.
The sight that greeted Ditch as he was heaved round to face forward was, if anything, even more terrifying than anything else he had witnessed since arriving in the accursed realm of Dragneepur. A wall of bodies, projecting feet jammed amongst staring faces, the occasional arm hanging out, twitching, dripping sweat. Here a knee, there a shoulder. Tangles of sodden hair, fingers with dagger-long nails. Human, demon, Forkral Asael, Kachain Chimal, others of nature's Ditch could not even identify. He saw one hand and forearm that appeared to be made entirely of metal, sockets and hinges and rods and a carapace of iron skin visible in mottled, pitted patches. Worst of all were the staring eyes, peering from faces that seemed to have surrendered every possible expression, leaving behind something slack and dull.
"Make space up top!" bellowed Draconis.
Cries of
"Now room!"
and
"Nowhere left!"
greeted him. Ignoring such protests, Draconis began climbing the wall of flesh. Faces twisted in rage and pain, eyes widened in affronted disbelief, hands clawed at him or beat him with fists, but the huge warrior was indifferent to all of it. Ditch could feel the man's enormous strength, an implacable certainty to every movement that bespoke something unconquerable. He was awed into silence. Higher they climbed, and shadows raced in crazed patterns now in the churning glare of the storm, as if the natural gloom of the world clung close to its surface, and here, high above it, the air was clearer, sharper. The rocking crawl of the wagon below was felt now in the swaying of the wall near the top, a motion groaned out in the slick shifting of flesh and in a wavering song of dull rhythmic moans and grunts. The wall finally sloped inward, and Ditch was tugged over hummocks of skin, the body so tight-packed that the surface beneath him seemed solid, an undulating landscape sheathed in sweat and flecks of ash and grime. Most of those lying here had settled on their stomachs, as if to stare at the sky that would vanish forever as soon as the next body arrived was too much to bear. Draconis rolled him into a depression between two backs, one facing one way, the other in the opposite direction. A man, a woman. A sudden contact with the woman's soft flesh as he was wedged against her startled an awakening in Ditch, and he cursed.
"Take what you can, mage," said Draconis.
Ditch heard him leaving. He could make out distinct voices now, odd nearby sounds. Someone was scrabbling closer, and Ditch felt a faint tug on his chain.
"Almost off, then. Almost off."
Ditch twisted round to see who had spoken. Atist Andy. He was clearly blind, and both sockets bore the terrible scarring of burns. Only deliberate torture could be that precise. His legs were gone, stumps visible just below his hips. He was dragging himself up alongside Ditch, and the mage saw that the creature held in one hand a long sharpened bone with a blackened point.
"Plan on killing me?" Ditch asked.
The Tist Andy paused, lifted his head. Straggly black hair framed a narrow, hollowed-out face.
"What sort of eyes do you have, friend?"
"Working ones."
A momentary smile, and then he squirmed closer. Ditch managed to shift round so that his ruined shoulder and arm were beneath him, freeing his undamaged arm.
"It's crazy, but I still intend to defend myself, though death, if it even exists here, would be a mercy."
"It doesn't," replied the Tist Andy. "I could stab you for the next 1,000 years and do nothing more than leave you full of holes. Full of holes."
He paused and the smile flickered once more.
"Yet I must stab you anyway, since you've made a mess of things. A mess, a mess, a mess."
"I have. Explain."
"There's no point, unless you have eyes."
"I have them, you damned fool."
"But can they see?"
He caught the emphasis on the last word. Could he awaken magic here? Could he scrape something from his warren, enough to attenuate his vision? There was nothing to do but try.
"Wait a moment," he said.
Oh, the warren was there, yes, as impervious as a wall. Yet he sensed something he had not expected. Cracks, fissures, things bleeding in, bleeding out. The effects of chaos, he realized.
"Gods, it's all breaking down!"
Would there be a time, he wondered, an instant, in the very moment that the storm finally struck them, when he would find his warren within reach? Could he escape before he was obliterated along with everyone and everything else?
"How long, how long, how long?"
asked the Tist Andy. Ditch found he could indeed scrape a residue of power. A few words muttered under his breath, and all at once he saw what had been hidden before. He saw, yes, the flesh he was lying on. A mass of tattoos blanketed every exposed patch of skin, lines and images crossing from one body to the next, yet nowhere could he see solid areas. All was made up of intricate, delicate traceries, patterns within patterns. He saw borders that dipped and twisted. He saw elongated figures with stretched faces and misshapen torsos. Not a single body atop this massive wagon had been exempted, barring Ditch's own. The Tistandi must have heard his gasp, for he laughed.
"Imagine yourself hovering, oh, say, 15 man-heights overhead. 15 man-heights. Overhead, overhead. Hovering in the air, just beneath the ceiling of nothingness, the ceiling of nothingness. Looking down upon all this, all this, all this. Aye, it looks awry to you from where you crouch, but from up there, from up there, from up there, you will see no mounds of flesh, no knobs of skin-stretched bones. You'll see no shadows at all, only the scene. The scene, yes. Laid flat, you'd swear. You'd swear it to every god and goddess you can think of. Flat, laid flat, laid flat.
Ditch struggled to comprehend what he was seeing. He did not dare attempt what the Tistandi had suggested, fearing the effort would drive him mad. No, he would not try to imagine himself plucked free of his flesh, his soul floating somewhere overhead. It was difficult enough to comprehend the obsession of this creation, a creation by a blind man.
"You've been up here for a long time," Ditch finally said, "avoiding getting buried."
"Yes and yes. I was among the first on the wagon. Among the first. Murdered by Draconis because I sought to wrest Dragnipur from him. Oh, Anamandaris Poraki was not the first to try. I was. And if I had won the sword, why, my first victim would have been Anamandaris himself. Is that not a bitter joke, friend? It is, it is."
"But this," Ditch gestured with his one hand, "it has to be a recent effort."
"No, only the last layer, the last layer, the last layer."
What do you use for ink?"
"Clever question. From the wagon, bloodwood, blackwood. The pitch and the pitch ever leaking out, ever sweating from the grain."
"Could I hover high up, as you say?" asked Ditch. "What scene would I see?"
"Wanderings, holds, houses, every god, every goddess, every spirit worth mentioning. Demon kings and demon queens, dragons and elders. Oh, all there, all there, all there. Is this where you mean to stay, friend? Is this where you mean to stay?"
Ditch thought of this creature hunkered up against him, that bone needle pricking his skin.
"No. I plan on crawling round as much as I can, never stopping. Leave me out of your scene."
"You cannot do that. You will ruin everything."
"Imagine me invisible, then. Imagine I don't even exist. I will stay out of your way."
The sightless eyes were glistening, and the Tistandi was shaking his head again and again.
"You will not have me," Ditch said. "Besides, it will all be ending soon."
"Soon? How soon? How soon? How soon? How soon?"
"The storm looks to be no more than a league behind us."
"If you will not join the scene," the Tistandi said, "I will push you off."
"Draconis might not like that."
"He will understand. He understands more than you, more than you, more and more and more than you."
"Just let me rest," said Ditch, "for a while. I will then climb back down. I don't want to be up here when the end comes. I want to be standing, facing the storm."
"Do you really imagine the ritual will awaken all at once? Do you, do you, do you? The flower opens soon, but the night is long, and it will take that long, for the flower to open, open in the moment before dawn, open in the moment. Draconis chose you, a mage, for the Nexus. I need the Nexus. You are the Nexus. Lie there, be quiet, don't move."
"No.
I cannot wait long, friend. Crawl about now if you like, but I cannot wait too long, a league away.
What is your name? Ditch asked.
What matter any of that?
For when I next speak to Draconis.
He knows me.
I don't.
I am Cadaspala, brother to Enesdia, who was wife to Anderist.
Anderist, that's one name I recognize. You wanted to murder the brother of your sister's husband?
I did. For what he did to them. What he did to them. For what he did to them!
Ditch stared at the anguish in the man's ravaged face.
Who blinded you, Cadaspala?
It was a gift. A mercy. I did not comprehend the truth of that. Not the real truth of it. The real truth. No. Besides, I thought my inner sight would be enough to challenge Draconis, to steal Dragnipur. I was wrong, wrong. I was wrong. The truth is a gift, a mercy.
Who blinded you?
The Tistandi flinched, then seemed to curl into himself. Tears glistened in the pits of his sockets.
I blinded myself,
Cadaspala whispered.
When I saw what he'd done. What he'd done to his brother, to my sister, to my sister.
Suddenly, Ditch did not want to ask any more questions of this man. He pushed himself from between the two bodies.
I am going to explore.
Come back, mage! Nexus! Come back! Come back!
We'll see.
With all this time to reflect on things, Apsalara concluded that her biggest mistake was not in finding her way into Moonspawn, nor in discovering the vaults and the heaps of magic stones, ensorcelled weapons, armor, the blood-dipped idols and reliquaries from 10,000 extinct cults. No, her greatest error in judgment had been in trying to stab Anamanda Rake in the back. He'd been amused at finding her. He'd not spoken of executing her, or even chaining her in some deep crypt for all eternity. He'd simply asked her how she had managed to break in. Curiosity, more than a little wonder, perhaps even some admiration. And then she went and tried to kill him. The damned sword had been out of its scabbard faster than an eye blink, the deadly edge slicing across her belly even as she lunged with her obsidian dagger. Such stupidity. But lessons only became lessons when one has reached the state of humility required to heed them. When one is past all the egotistical excuses and explanations flung up to fend off honest culpability. It was nature to attack first, abjuring all notions of guilt and shame, lash out, white with rage, then strut away convinced of one's own righteousness. She had long since left such imbecilic posturing behind. A journey of enlightenment. And it had begun with her last mortal breath as she found herself lying on the hard stone floor, looking up into the eyes of Anamanda Rake, and seeing his dismay, his regret, his sorrow. She could feel the growing heat of the storm, could feel its eternal hunger. Not long now, and then all her efforts would be for naught. The kinks of the chain finally showed some wear, but not enough, not nearly enough. She would be destroyed along with everyone else. She was not unique. She was, in fact, no different from every other idiot who'd tried to kill Rake or Draconis. The rain trickling down from the wagon bed was warmer than usual, foul with sweat, blood, and worse. It streamed over her body. Her skin had been wet for so long it was coming away in ragged pieces, white with death, revealing raw red meat underneath. She was rotting. The time was coming when she would have to drop down once more, emerge from under the wagon, and see for herself the arrival of oblivion. There would be no pity in its eyes, not that it had any, just the indifference that was the other face of the universe, the one all would have forever turned away. The regard of chaos was the true source of terror. All the rest were but flavors, variations.
I was a child once, I am certain of it. A child. I have a memory, one memory of that time. On a barren bank of a broad river, the sky was blue perfection. The caribou were crossing the river, in their tens and tens of thousands. I remember their upthrust heads. I remember seeing the weaker ones crowded in, pushed down to vanish in the murky water. These carcasses would wash up down current, where the short-nosed bears and the wolves and eagles and ravens waited for them. But I stood with others, father, mother, perhaps sisters and brothers, just others, my eyes on the vast herd. Their seasonal migration, and this was but one of many places of crossing. The caribou often chose different paths. Still, the river had to be crossed, and the beasts would mill for half a morning on the bank, until they plunged into the current, until all at once they were flooding the river, a surging tide of hide and flesh, of breaths drawn in and gusted out. Not even the beasts display eagerness when accosting the inevitable, when it seems numbers alone can possibly confuse fate, and so each life strives, strikes out into the icy flow. Save me! That is what is written in their eyes. Save me above all the others. Save me so that I may live. Give me this moment, this day, this season. I will follow the laws of my kind.
She remembered that one moment when she was a child, and she remembered her sense of awe in witnessing the crossing, in that force of nature, that imposition of will, its profound implacability. She remembered, too, the terror she had felt.
Caribou are not just caribou. The crossing is not just this crossing. The caribou are all life. The river is the passing world. Life swims through, riding the current, swims, drowns, triumphs. Life can ask questions. Life, some of it, can even ask, how is it that I can ask anything at all? And how is it that I believe that answers answer anything worthwhile? What value this exchange, this precious dialogue, when the truth is unchanged, when some live for a time while others drown, when in the next season there are new caribou while others are forever gone? The truth is unchanged. Each spring, in the time of crossing, the river is in flood, chaos swirls beneath the surface. It is the worst time. Watch us.
The child had not wanted to see. The child had wailed and fled inland. Brothers and sisters pursued, laughing maybe, not understanding her fear, her despair. Someone pursued, anyway, laughing, unless it was the river that laughed, and it was the herd of caribou that surged up from the bank and lunged forward, driving the watchers to scatter, shouting their surprise. Perhaps that was what had made her run. She wasn't sure. The memory ended with her panic, her cries, her confusion. Lying on the crossbeam, the wood sweating beneath her, Apsalara felt like that child once again. The season was coming. The river awaited her in fullest flood, and she was but one among many, praying for fate's confusion.